Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are discussing the U.S.-backed Israeli assault on Gaza, and some of the content we will be discussing is disturbing. At last week's Democratic National Convention, anti-war uncommitted delegates said they were in talks with high-level Democrats about having a Palestinian-American speak from the stage, but the demand was denied. During the primaries, nearly 800,000 voters across the country selected a version of an uncommitted vote to send a message to the Democratic Party. Who is listening and what is next for the movement? Doctors who volunteered in Gaza shared devastating stories at a press conference during the convention. They said the Israeli Defense Forces have made it impossible to treat their patients. Gaza's health ministry says over 40,000 Palestinians have been killed, including 17,000 children. That is almost 3% of all children in Gaza who are now dead. Al Jazeera reports that at least 53 children have been killed every day since October 7th, and 72 men and women are killed in Israeli strikes every single day. The death toll could exceed 186,000 when you factor in the thousands of people buried under the rubble and the deaths due to the destruction of public infrastructures like health facilities. This is according to a study published in The Lancet. Joining us to talk about all of this are three guests. Leila Alabed is co-chair of the Uncommitted Movement. She attended last week's convention and press conference. Before a rally in Detroit, Michigan earlier this month, Leila Alabed briefly met with Vice President Kamala Harris, urging her to support a ceasefire and an arms embargo. The vice president agreed to a meeting. Leila is also an organizer with We the People in Southeast Michigan. More than 100,000 Michigan Democratic primary voters cast ballots for uncommitted. Reuters reports that Biden won Michigan in 2020 by only 154,000 votes. Biden was beaten by the uncommitted vote in Dearborn and Hamtramck, where Arab Americans make up close to half the population. Hi, Leila. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
We're also joined by Dr. Thayer Ahmad, a board-certified emergency medicine physician in Chicago and a Med Global board member who volunteered in the Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in January with Med Global. That's a humanitarian charitable NGO. In April, Dr. Thayer Ahmad walked out of a meeting with President Biden and members of the Muslim American community. He was the only Palestinian American in the room. He gave President Biden a letter from Hadil, an 8-year-old orphan who is in a camp in Rafah. The letter begged President Biden to ensure there was no invasion of Rafah by the Israelis. Hi, Dr. Ahmad. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Tanya Haj Hassan is a pediatric intensive care and humanitarian doctor who has also volunteered in Gaza. At the press conference during the convention, Dr. Haj Hassan described holding the hands of dying children, taking their last final gasps with no family alive able to comfort them. There is a term for wounded children arriving alone in hospitals because it is now so common. Wounded child, no surviving family. Hi, Dr. Haj Hassan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Leila, let's start with you. We talked about what happened at the convention last week. Can you give us a sense of what happened behind the scenes? That the uncommitted movement was in talks with high-level Democrats about having a Palestinian-American speak, but the demand was ultimately denied. Can you just tell us how this all went down?
Yeah, I mean, this is something, within our movement, we have movement demands and we had our DNC demands because our movement earned almost 800,000 uncommitted voters who then elected 30 uncommitted delegates in states that won delegates to represent those voters. So these were uncommitted delegates elected by Democratic voters. Our DNC demands were that we wanted a space within the DNC to hold our vigils and our press conferences. We wanted to be able to have credentials for our uncommitted team to support those 30 uncommitted delegates. And we also wanted a speaker. We petitioned for that speaker to be Tanya Haj Hassan, who has no political agenda, but is a doctor that can speak to that very human impact of our U.S. policy decisions, as she has treated the men, women, and children who have been suffering through the Israeli assault on Palestinians. And we also asked for speaking time for a uncommitted leader or an uncommitted delegate or even a Palestinian American. And behind the scenes, so they've known about this, these demands, these specific DNC demands, besides our movement demands, which is not another bomb, which is a policy change that ends the killing and occupation of Palestinians. And so we've submitted these demands, you know, 2 months prior to the Democratic National Convention. And, you know, when Biden was at the top of the ticket, we weren't getting a lot of headway in those conversations. And so with the shift from Biden to Harris being on the top of the ticket, it did open up opportunities to have those conversations with leaders within the Democratic National Convention, as well as Harris campaign staff. And, you know, we were just even days before the Democratic National Convention, I met with DNC staff who, you know, said they were working with the campaign team and they were working with the DNC programming to kind of meet as many of our requests and demands that our movement was making. And really the whole time, we were never discouraged that we wouldn't have a speaker on the main stage of the DNC. You know, we were told that, you know, keep submitting names, keep, you know, we're keeping the pressure up. We're doing everything on our end to push for this request. We know how essential this request was. And in all honesty, we really thought we were presenting something to the Democratic Party leadership within the Democratic Party, something on a silver platter that could help us mobilize voters in our state, especially in key swing states like Michigan, where I'm from, to be able to mobilize voters to support Vice President Harris, you know, because we were hoping that we would have that signal that she would turn a page away from President Biden's disastrous, immoral Gaza policy and how she was differentiating herself from Trump. And unfortunately, that's not what we left with. I think that it was a big mistake of the Democratic Party and the Harris team to not take this opportunity to really, truly unite the Democratic Party, as the majority of Democratic voters right now support a permanent and immediate ceasefire and conditioning a military aid on Israel. Most voters do not want to see their tax dollars being used to kill men, women, and children. And war is not popular. And so what we've seen from that main stage really, honestly, to me, does not reflect you know, the sentiments and the stated core values of the Democratic Party or even Vice President Harris's campaign team. And I think it is incredibly unfortunate and it was a missed opportunity. But in all honesty, our movement has come out stronger than it was before the DNC.
And Georgia State Representative Rua Roman was supposed to speak, and by now a lot of people have either read the speech she was going to make or have heard her say the speech. And she, in the speech, she did say that she was endorsing Kamala Harris for president. It was a pretty moderate speech. She was going to tell a personal story about her family, and she did not give that speech. She's also running for re-election. Dr. Ahmad, before we talk about your time in Gaza, you were at the press conference of Palestinians, doctors, others who have been to Gaza. What are your thoughts about how this all went down at last week's convention?
Well, I think it's extremely disappointing. And I think part of what we as healthcare workers who've been in Gaza have been trying to communicate is, you know, there is this consensus from the entire humanitarian relief community, from healthcare workers to aid workers, everybody that has kind of witnessed what has taken place on the ground. There's this consensus that there is absolutely a tragic situation that has unfolded in Gaza, and every single day it becomes even more catastrophic. We're just trying to communicate that message, and we're trying to at least share that story so that people can finally see the reality of what's on the ground. You know, if you have a speaker like Dr. Tanya Haj Hassan, who's going to go up on the stage and be able to tell you about the children that she treated and everybody that she had seen, we think that's incredibly powerful, and it will get us closer to what is absolutely necessary, which is a ceasefire, which is a cessation of the hostilities in a way that can bring relief to the people in Gaza. I mean, every single person who has entered into Gaza since January, since the end of December when they started allowing people to come in until as of yesterday, they're coming back with the same message. They're coming back with the same sort of horrors that they've seen. And I think we feel that there's this duty that we want to at least share the stories. We want people to be able to hear them because we think that they're powerful enough to sway the hearts and minds of people in elected office, for that matter. So just to be censored and to be erased from the conversation, the fact that there was no space for people to be able to communicate this vital message that is not controversial, that is not polarizing. I mean, it was extremely unfortunate. It was very disappointing. And I don't think people realize, you know, that this is continuing to contribute to this sort of catastrophe that's unfolding. If people don't know about it, how can we step up and get an end to this? If people are not familiar with what's happening on the ground, if they don't hear the intimate details that we want to share, then how can we develop that momentum to bring an end to the horrifying things that are taking place?
Dr. Haj Hassan, what would you like to add?
No, I agree completely with Dr. Ahmed. There has been absolute consensus and an overwhelming message from everybody that comes back from Gaza. And it's not just individuals, it's organizations, and it's organizations across the humanitarian, human rights, and medical relief industry in general. Everybody's coming back with the same message. And you see it. You see directors from UNICEF come out on air and just say, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. You see people from Save the Children come out and say the same thing. You have Human Rights Watch that today published a report on the detention and torture of healthcare workers, and the fact that there have been well over 200 healthcare workers who have been detained and tortured, many of whom who have been released. And when testimonies are taken from these healthcare workers, you hear over and over again that they're detained for their profession, not for crimes committed as individuals. They're called in as the person wearing scrubs or the person in the doctor's coat. And then they get detained and tortured for months, you know, physical, sexual, psychological torture. And these reports have been coming out. There was one recently published by Amnesty International, and again, the one by Human Rights Watch just this week. And, you know, this universal consensus amongst everybody, universal condemnation of what's happening on the ground, supported by findings by the International Court of Justice, supported by eyewitnesses on the ground, supported by documented realities that you introduced the show with. You know, the statistics are harrowing. This assault is breaking all the worst kind of records. You know, highest number of pediatric amputees, highest number of journalists killed, humanitarian workers killed, healthcare workers killed, over 17,000 children who lost one or both parents since October. And just to add, that figure is several months outdated. I'm scared to know what that figure is today. Mm-hmm. The same thing is true for the other figures you mentioned. All means of census in Gaza at the moment have been destroyed. We have very little knowledge of what's happening in the north of Gaza. We know it's catastrophic. We know people are starving, but we don't know numbers. We don't know how many people are being killed. We don't know how many children have been orphaned, how many children have had their limbs amputated. So it's really hard to get accurate data. But up until the point that we got accurate data, and that's a while ago now,
this assault is breaking the worst kind of records, records that, you know, only wars can break, and even then, unprecedented in our lifetime for certain. And, you know, the really devastating thing is I've been working in the humanitarian sector for a number of years now, and there are international humanitarian laws that protect against these sorts of crimes, that protect against this horrific and egregious, atrocious impact on civilians. And those international laws are being violated systematically. And so when they're violated systematically, and yet it continues to be an assault that's funded by the U.S. military, those of us who are eyes on the ground have a duty both to our professions, to the people who are suffering under these violations, and to the human race in general, to speak up about it, particularly when international journalists have been barred from entering, when independent investigators have been barred from entering, from all other independent means of bearing witness to these atrocities have been prohibited from bearing witness to them. We feel a particular duty to do so, and a particular duty to convey those things to the political community with the power to stop this in an instant.
Dr. Haj Hassan, I have watched you for months talk about what you have seen in Gaza. And we've been talking on this show for months about the horrific videos that we are seeing taken by either Palestinian journalists or Palestinians in Gaza, because, as you said, international journalists are not permitted to enter. And it's just been absolutely horrific. This is a very simple question, but Dr. Haj Hassan, did you think that by now, because of the videos that are coming out and the absolute devastation that has happened, this would have ended by now?
I honestly thought it would have ended within the first week when I got those first messages out of hospitals, out of it. So just a little bit of background. I've been going to the Gaza Strip for more than 10 years to teach. So many of my colleagues there, people who were former students of ours or more senior colleagues who we developed relationships with when we were there, we've been in communication with for years. So during the 2021 assault, we were in frequent communication. During the 2014 assault, we were in frequent communication. And so, you know, it's not the first time we text back and forth about the mass casualties that are coming in and how they're managing them. But this was different. You know, they were saying, we've never seen anything like this. It's indescribable. This feels like Judgment Day. It's a genocide. From day five, they were saying it's a genocide, talking about, you know, hundreds coming in within the space of an hour, you know, entire families who are either killed in an instant, maimed, coming in. You know, it was really horrific those first few days. And that's why myself and a few of my other colleagues from Oxford University, the group that historically would go and teach in Gaza, we decided to set up a platform called Gaza Medic Voices, because we thought, wait, this is different. And this is not being conveyed in mainstream media. We need to make sure that we convey it. And so we did through this platform. And I remember within that first week, and if anyone listening to this goes to those platforms on Instagram or on Twitter, it's called Gaza Medic Voices, and scrolls to the very, very beginning, you know, that first week, we're talking October 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and looks at the messages we were receiving from healthcare workers at that time. You would have never imagined that the world would have allowed this to continue for 10 months. Mm. It was just so horrific. And I can pull up some of those messages right now. And then, you know, coming on the news and seeing not, you know, forget my voice. Think about the voices of all the credible international organizations who month after month have come on. James Elder from UNICEF from the very beginning, you know, just crying out to the world, this has to stop. Same thing with Save the Children. It's just, nobody ever thought that this would go on for this long. And you mentioned, just as you were asking me this question, you mentioned all the Palestinian footage we're getting, you know, Palestinian journalists who've been sharing this from the very beginning. And, I add to that the voices of the Palestinian healthcare workers who have been sounding the alarms from the very beginning. But the problem is we do not listen to the Palestinian voice. And that was, you know, confirmed in a very sad, shameful and unjust way when the DNC refused to have a Palestinian speaker, you know, refused to give a Palestinian American 2 minutes of stage time. We need to start listening to Palestinian voices. Time and time again, they have been sounding the alarm from the very beginning. And the fact that even when it comes to footage, we question footage that comes from Palestinians, we question data that comes from Palestinian authorities, even when The Lancet and other independent well-established sources tell you that that data is accurate and actually is historically an underestimate of the casualties. We continue, as I say we, but mainstream media and the political forces that be, continue to cast doubt on Palestinian testimony. And that's extremely problematic and adds to the systematic dehumanization of a people who are frankly being genocided.
Dr. Ahmad, you are Palestinian. Did you think this would have lasted this long, given what we are all witnessing on a daily basis?
You know, I don't think I ever imagined that we'd be at this point. We're approaching 11 months, and that all of the safeguards that exist in the world, all of the international humanitarian law, all of the different bodies that exist that are supposed to prevent something like this from taking place. I never thought that we would see the collapse of this in less than a year. And it's not just that it's lasted this long. I think all of us are absolutely stunned that we're seeing some of the things emerge out of the Gaza Strip. The way that this war has been prosecuted, the fact that there is a 10-month-old in Gaza right now who is paralyzed because of polio. I mean, a disease that has been eradicated for more than a quarter of a century that is easily preventable as long as there are vaccines that are able to enter into this space. I never thought that we'd get to this point. I never thought that we would watch children starve to death. You never imagined that we would get to a point where all of the Gaza Strip has been displaced multiple times. It's truly unfathomable the way that this war has been prosecuted and the devastation that we've seen. I did not expect us to have to be in this sort of position. I think Tani says it right. I didn't think that we would make it out of October with this still going on. But when you realize that on October 8th, that the water was shut off and the electricity was turned off, and then you start to see week by week different healthcare institutions, universities, schools, shelters, one by one get surrounded, get attacked, get raided, people are getting arrested. The fact that we've gotten to this point right here, I just don't know even how we recover from this. I don't know how we recover as a society. I don't know how we recover, the international community recovers from this. I mean, it's the evidence is there. The videos have emerged. I think if anybody was, you know, really wanted to figure out what was taking place, they could. But instead, what we've seen is we've seen a double standard when it comes to the Gaza Strip. We've seen the fact that there is no such thing as like a moral or principled approach when it comes to upholding the letter of the law and when it comes to international humanitarian law or human rights. And, you know, for us to be at this point, we want a war. We want the ceasefire to take place as soon as possible. Everybody's desperate for that. But this idea people are talking about the day after, and I think, you know, Dr. Tanya alluded to this, but everything that we know that's emerging from the Gaza Strip, all the information that we have, it's sort of a glimpse. We know that many of the things that we're hearing about the casualty count or the injured or the resources that are available, we know that it's probably worse than it is. And you cited the Lancet article that came out a couple of months ago. So when the dust settles and we do get access and there is aid entering, I think we're going to be devastated by what we find out. I think that the numbers are going to be astronomically higher. And you start thinking about, well, if the day after looks like the day before, even if the war is over, then many more people will still die. If the fact that we still can't bring in aid into the Gaza Strip without some sort of blockade that's in place, innocent people will die. And the other thing I'll say is, you know, one thing that really got to me and really affected me was there's a story that came out today about an elderly woman named Fatima. She's an 86-year-old, and she survived the Nakba in 1948, that massive displacement that took place to many Palestinians. And she ended up in the Gaza Strip. She died today in a tent in Gaza. And, you know, I think that just tells you just how horrifying and tragic the situation is. It's just what the Palestinian people in Gaza have been through over the last 11 months. I don't know how the world can recover from this. And I don't know, you know, where we go from here, but I just hope that it stops sooner rather than later.
Leila, what would you like to add?
I mean, as I'm hearing from Thaed, Dr. Thaed Ahmed and Dr. Tanya Haj Hassan, you know, it brings me back to one of the press conferences that we had during the DNC and how it was really devastating to hear the stories that they shared. And I kept thinking that, like, I really hope that the right people are listening to this press conference, or that this press conference and the words that were spoken here reach the people that need to hear this, the policymakers and the lawmakers. Because absolutely right. I don't know how we as a country and we as just globally are going to recover from, you know, our complicity in, you know, Netanyahu's collective punishment of Palestinians, but not only that, our complicity in our apartheid and occupation that Palestinians have been surviving the last 76 years. I will continue to take up my lane within the Democratic Party, as well as my brothers and sisters who are taking up lanes on the streets, rallying, advocating, mobilizing, you know, the doctors here who are lending their voices for so many Palestinians in Gaza who are voiceless right now. I will take up this lane in order to push our movement demands, because it is what most Democrats want. It is what most voters want. It is what most people of conscience. And war is not a popular policy. And I really, really believe that we have to do everything in all of our power to move away from being okay with this. It has been a policy of the last 76 years. And I don't believe that we can no longer just sit by and uplift the status quo.
Before we let you go, Leila, what are you hearing from some of the, I mean, this is a massive number, 800,000 voters selected a version of an uncommitted vote during the primaries to send a message to the Democratic Party. I mentioned in the intro that more than 100,000 people in Michigan voted uncommitted, and Biden won in 2020 by just 154,000 votes in Michigan. What are you hearing from some of these people?
You know, I live in Dearborn, Michigan. I'm a regional community organizer outside of being a co-founder and co-director of the Uncommitted National Movement. But what I'm hearing for folks, you know, there's a lot of folks that are very apathetic about the November presidential elections. We are hearing, you know, these voters, even within the anti-war coalition outside of the Arab American, Muslim American community, but like just anti-war voters who voted uncommitted in the presidential primary are not going to vote in a monolith. And what I do honestly fear, especially after what happened at the DNC, is a mass exit of voters from the Democratic Party. I fear that because, not because I believe Democratic leaders are going to be our heroes, because right now they aren't even aligned with the core base of their constituents, of Democratic voters, but because we need people power to shift policy. And that's something I'm really committed to moving forward. This work doesn't end, you know, just because we have the DNC. It's not going to end in November. It is a ongoing movement. And I just really hope that folks want to invest in the liberation of Palestine because it's the right thing to do. And I, in all honesty, I just can't be a citizen of this country and a Democrat and not use my voice and my vote, to stop the ongoing genocide. And I encourage, other Democrats and other folks who see this as their lane, to, you know, plug in at, on our website, plug into notanotherbomb.com. So we are as powerful as possible, to shift these lawmakers and policymakers.
Leila El-Abed is co-chair of the Uncommitted Movement, who attended last week's Democratic National Convention and press conference. Dr. Fair Ahmad is a board-certified emergency medicine doctor in Chicago and a Med Global board member who volunteered in the Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in January with Med Global. Dr. Tanya Haj Hassan is a pediatric intensive care and humanitarian doctor who's volunteered in Gaza and, as you heard, has been involved in training doctors in Gaza for many, many years. She and her colleagues started Gaza Medic Voices. Dr. Haj Hassan, Dr. Ahmad, and Leila, thank you all for your work, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up after a break, we will speak with an emergency room and pediatric nurse, Sandy Adler-Killen, who is treating Dr. Juman Arfa in Gaza via remote telehealth during her pregnancy. She was tragically killed by an Israeli airstrike along with her newborn twins and her mother. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you are just tuning in, we want to let you know that some of the content we'll be discussing and a clip we will be playing is disturbing. Now we'd like to welcome Sandy Adler-Killen back to the show. Sandy is an emergency room and pediatric nurse who has provided support for newborns in Gaza. She is a member of a group of lactation consultants supporting moms in Gaza via telehealth. We had Sandy on a few months ago when she returned to Gaza, and she's planning to go back. She was treating Dr. Juman Arfa via remote telehealth during her pregnancy and birth. Dr. Juman Arfa was tragically killed by an Israeli airstrike along with her newborn twins and her mother. Hi, Sandy. Thank you so much for joining us again.
You're so welcome, Rose. Thank you so much for continuing to cover this horrific situation.
Well, can you tell us how you first were connected with Dr. Juman Arfa and how you take part in remote telehealth from the Bay Area, reaching out to and helping women in Gaza?
So this was a unique situation. While I was there in March and April of this year, I worked with a Berlin-based NGO called Kadus, and we were working at a trauma stabilization point in Al-Muasi, a little bit south of Khan Yunis. And we were working side by side with the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, and they had two tents set up, and we would flow between the tents working with them, dealing with mass casualty incidents. But we also, because we were located right in the community, we were providing primary care. We were providing, we had births in the tent, many pediatric patients, many ongoing wound care patients who couldn't get the coverage or being able to meet with plastic surgeons. There was just no availability. So we were managing their wounds as best we could with the limited facilities and equipment we had. But so I've been in touch with my Palestinian colleagues, the doctors and nurses that I connected with while I was there. And I got a call. It was probably about 4 weeks ago now, from one of the physicians that I had worked with, and she connected me with Jumana. And Jumana and I were communicating via WhatsApp, video and audio, and she would send me many, many messages also about her situation and what was going on. I was supporting her during her pregnancy, and then after the babies were born, and I had an appointment, a video appointment scheduled with her on the evening of the day she was killed to help her increase her milk supply to be able to feed her twins. And I received the message and was just completely devastated by the news. And my heart just breaks for her husband. Mm.
You say that you have many voicemails from Dr. Jumana Arfa regarding how scared she was and what she was dealing with. Can you just tell us a bit more about her and her story?
Yes. just as a prelude, excuse me, I'm sorry. Without exception, the communication that I've had with my colleagues in Gaza, as I said, the doctors and nurses, it's always been, don't worry about us, we're okay. The grace, the composure, the professionalism. When I reach out to them and I hear things in the news and I want to check in and make sure they're okay. When I first connected with Jumana, it was the same. And then throughout the next couple weeks, things had changed dramatically for her. So the voicemails were alluded to being displaced multiple times. She felt like she was just running in circles. She was so fearful of having her twins early. She knew of women who had died in childbirth. She knew her babies were breached. She had gotten access to an ultrasound appointment, and she saw that her babies were breached. This is a woman who's a physician, so she was acutely aware of her need for a C-section. She knew that there was no anesthetic in terms of managing her pain during surgery. And then, of course, she was worried about, you know, the health of her children being born prematurely, not having enough milk. Some of her voicemails, she shared, she had Braxton Hicks contractions, which are kind of a false labor. And she said it was specifically related to the stress that she was enduring, and she knew that she had to find a way to help minimize the stress, but she was just so afraid. She was so exhausted, and she just continually asked me, please pray for us, please pray for us.
Mm. I remember reading about this and watching a horrific video of what happened when her husband found out. And I want to play this August 14th clip from Sky News about the deadly airstrike that killed Dr. Jumana Arfa, her twins, and her mother.
Mohammed became a father 4 days ago. Today he went to hospital in central Gaza to pick up the birth certificates of his newborn twins. Instead, he ended up in the morgue to identify the bodies of his wife and two babies. They were killed by an Israeli airstrike whilst he was out.
People from the neighborhood called me and told me that my house I live in was bombed. My wife, my two children, and my mother-in-law were gone. My wife gave birth the day before yesterday. I didn't even have the time to celebrate them. She gave birth by cesarean section, and she was still tired and couldn't walk.
The airstrike hit their top floor apartment. We asked the IDF for a statement, but haven't received one. Inside, the house is still smoldering from the explosion. They use bottles of water to try and put out the fire still burning. Any sign of family life has already been extinguished.
Thanks to Sky News for that clip. This is just such a devastating story, Sandy, and there are so many others like this. You have to think, what has happened to her husband? How is he dealing with all of this? I mean, are you in touch with anyone who is connected to him?
Yeah. So I tried to reach out to him through the physician that connected me with Jumana. You know, I don't know if he speaks English. Her English was excellent. Jumana had nothing to do with Hamas. She just cared about peace. She was somebody who cared about the children that were being harmed, killed in Gaza. And I know that she had a social media presence posting about trying to advocate for ceasefire and peace. And one of the reasons why I'm talking to you today, Rose, is I don't want her story forgotten. I want to continue to advocate as much as I can for an immediate ceasefire, an arms embargo. We must stop this indiscriminate, this killing of so many innocent people that I saw with my own eyes while I was there. And then, of course, the situation here, it's beyond horrific. And I have no idea why her apartment was hit. It was a direct hit to her apartment and where she was recovering from her birth. She had sent me pictures the day they were born of her and her babies. She had sent me pictures the day before we were going to be having our video chat. And she was just lying in bed surrounded with her babies. And it was such a place of hope and joy in the midst of this horror. And to have that wiped out in an instant, there's no way to come to terms with what's going on and this kind of horror.
I actually found her Facebook page, and on August 10th, she posted new twins with hearts around their names, Asser and Isel. I want to ask you the same question I asked our previous guests, Sandy. Given that we are seeing such horror unfold before our very eyes, thanks to the Palestinian journalists on the ground, the hospital staff who are videotaping this. I mean, I can't even imagine being the person behind the phone who's videotaping Dr. Jumana's husband as he just screams in horror. Did you think that this would have ended by now, given that the world is seeing this unfold before our very eyes?
Well, I know, Rose, that while I was there, everybody thought that it would. This was back in March, April.
Because you saw this in person.
Yes, all of my Palestinian colleagues there, amazing, amazing, beautiful human beings. They were just in disbelief that it was going on. They said, "We never imagined it would continue." And of course, as we know, with the closing of Rafah, things have even gotten worse. I know. I'm planning on returning in about a month or so to focus on infant feeding and nutrition. And, you know, when I went previously, we were able to bring medicine, medical supplies to replenish what was being used. And now it's so limited. Before I could bring in four crates, small crates of small boxes with me. And now, you know, it's one bag. So I can't even imagine how people are coping. I can't even imagine. You know, I talk almost every other morning with my colleagues there to just check in to see how they are. And as they're continuing to be displaced and the work they're doing, they have to set up in new areas continually. And obviously, not only is it putting an incredible stress on them as individuals, but in terms of the infrastructure and being able to provide medical support. Yeah, none of us imagined. I thought there was going to be a ceasefire when they first talked about it before I went in March. And at this point, and I did want to just share, you know, I was very, very hopeful during the, I know it was alluded to and discussed in the previous segment about the recent DNC, and I was so incredibly disappointed that the Palestinian representatives were not given a voice, were not given an opportunity to speak even for a moment or two. To me, not only is that not being compassionate, but it's also, to me, I don't think it's politically smart. I mean, you have a whole community of not only Palestinians, but people in this country that are working so hard to advocate for peace and an immediate ceasefire whose voices are not being heard. So, yeah, so much of this, of course, doesn't make sense to any of us here and any people, any of the Palestinians there.
We're speaking with Sandy Adler-Killen, a Bay Area emergency room and pediatric nurse who is providing support for newborns in Gaza. She was in Gaza earlier this year and is planning to go back. I want to play one more clip that really just speaks to what children are dealing with in Gaza. This is Sky News. They tell the story of Reem, a five-month-old who lost her entire family. In this clip, you will hear from Dr. Ahmad Al-Farah, a pediatrician.
Reem will never know her parents. They were killed in another airstrike, leaving the five-month-old an orphan. Her body is pockmarked with wounds from shrapnel. She is the only survivor from her family.
She's refused any kind of feeding. This is one of the very sad and catastrophic story we have ever seen in this war. A lot of these sad stories nowadays.
For now, Reem is in the arms of her aunt, but the doctors are desperately trying to find a surrogate mother to breastfeed her before she gets any weaker.
Again, thanks to Sky News for that clip. That is just devastating, Sandy, to think that they're now trying to find surrogate mothers to breastfeed babies like Reem because their mothers were killed. How common is this? Do you know?
Yeah, that particular situation, I honestly don't have the facts about how common it is. But from my time there, one thing I wanted to mention that whenever there were individuals, we had, I'll never forget, this one young woman, teenager, her whole family was wiped out. People had found her wandering the streets. And one of the Palestinian Red Crescent Society workers took her in, you know, a stranger, even though they had obviously a lack of food and water and resources. But the people there, they take care of each other. I'm working, besides what I'm doing in terms of my own connections, I'm working with a community of lactation consultants that they're based in the UK that have set up a system where there's a team of community health workers that we interface with the staff at the hospital and the current NICUs and labor and delivery. I think there's one L&D hospital now functioning. And so we provide support for them to instill that these babies are getting nutrition. Whether when I was there previously, I brought over 30 manual breast pumps that I delivered to Al-Aqsa and Emirati's hospitals, the two operating NICUs at that point. And I have two cases with me that I'm planning on bringing back when I go to be able to continue to support milk production there in an area where there's a lack of formula, there's a lack of resources. So this situation, you know, in terms of infant feeding, you know, we have in the NICU, I saw there were five newborns in an incubator. There just are not resources. There is not facilities. There is not sufficient equipment, supplies. Many of these babies are dying of malnutrition. And of course, it's challenging, but we're doing what we can from afar.
I should also say we didn't have time to ask Dr. Thayer Ahmad about this, but in other interviews, he said that, and other doctors have said that the good people of their states have donated so many desperately needed supplies, but they were not allowed to bring them in. Final thoughts, Sandy, given that you saw this, I mean, you were in Gaza treating patients. You're going back. What else do you think is missing? For those who are not seeing the videos on a regular basis, what else do you think is missing from the media coverage we're hearing about? What is actually happening to Palestinians who are having to deal with these, with bombs and gunshot wounds and an infrastructure that just can't handle all of this because it's been devastated?
Right. I mean, there's so many interviews that have been done, so many incredibly articulate people, much more knowledgeable than I, have spoken about this issue. Rose, you know, I think, you know, just in terms of my own personal opinion, I think that for so long, historically, There's so many populations in this world that have been marginalized, that have been seen as lesser than. And so for me, I think a lot of people feel separate still from the Palestinian community. And I know for myself, having had experiences, I had been in the West Bank prior to October 7th, and just the love and connection and caring and the warm-heartedness and the humanity of the Palestinian people is just incredible. I mean, again, you'll see it in many communities in the world, but this particular one just touched me so deeply, and I feel such an amazing, I feel like they're my family, and they're my brothers and sisters. And I think until we all together realize that, they are us, you know, there is no other, there is no stranger. And I think that's the only way for us to realize that we must continue to pressure and advocate for an immediate ceasefire. And we must pressure for an arms embargo, even if temporarily it's conditional. But it has to stop. We must have a respite. We must have a break.
Sandy Adler-Killen is a Bay Area emergency room and pediatric nurse who provides support for newborns in Gaza. She's a member of a group of lactation consultants supporting moms via telehealth. Sandy was in Gaza earlier this year and plans to return. Sandy, huge respect for the important work you do, and thank you for joining us. We'd love to have you back once you return. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rose, for your time.
Thank you. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show, and thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.